Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me today are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five biggest stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. We are also live every Thursday at 2 p.m., except next week, which will be Wednesday at 2 p.m. So subscribe on YouTube at IEN Magazine to get a notification when we go live every Thursday at 2 p.m., except next week, which will be Wednesday at 2 p.m. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
Good, David. And I was told that I was mean to you on last week's episode.
Oh!
So I just want you to know I'm going to try to be better.
Nice.
And I am sorry if I...
Did my son
hurt your feelings or anything like that? No, it was not your son.
You were mean to me?
Apparently I was.
Oh, so. Which time? No.
I thought it was pretty consistent the whole time since we've started.
Yeah,
160 episodes ago.
Yeah, no. It hasn't exactly been like 162 episodes of like niceties.
Agreed.
Yeah, no. It's the mix.
Must have been the tone or something.
Oh, but. Well, I didn't lose any sleep over here. Yeah. I mean, thank you.
I'll try.
Rightfully
Somebody told you to watch your tone?
Yeah.
Okay. It's good. You know, it's the price that we pay when like friends and loved ones watch the podcast.
I suppose.
And then we get scolded just like, everyone else seemed pretty cool with it, man. Like, we actually tone our banter way down. You should see us after like three cocktails. Then it's like, well, I'll tell you what's wrong with this story.
Maybe that's next week.
Yeah. Oh, that could be like a holiday. You know, like get the eggnog out.
I like it.
Anna, how are you doing this week?
You drink eggnog during spring break?
I like a good early spring nog. Like it really smooths over spring break.
Oh, yeah. Just like on the beach in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just like a permanent light brown mustache.
A yard of eggnog.
Yeah. Like a giant, what was the Eiffel Tower from Vegas full of nog.
I feel like you can put ice and rum in just about anything and be good with
maybe,
it.
Maybe so.
Just like, boys, entertain yourselves. Daddy's into the nog. but you have plans for spring break, so you're actually out next week.
Yes, I will be out for the switch to Wednesday podcast with eggnog. I will not be for that.
The Nogcast. Safe travels for you and your family.
Thank you.
All right. Before we jump into our first episode this week, we have first story of this week's episode.
Both.
Yeah.
It's fair.
All of it. We got a word from our sponsor.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, Industrial Equipment News, and Manufacturing Business Technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Office MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Office MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Office MDT. He's also a member of the Office MDT product team.
Hey, we're back, and this week's episode is brought to you by Office MDT. The Secrets of OT Data Management is an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers looking to stay ahead of the curve in today's digital landscape. So join Office MDT's Dave McGovern, Jim Englehart, and Jeff Ranke. No, he's ours. He's not theirs. As they unveil the secrets of data management for manufacturers. Learn effective OT data management, control, cybersecurity, implementation, shortcuts, and more. Watch it now. Our first story this week. Bernie Sanders wants the U.S. to adopt 32-hour work weeks. Senator Bernie Sanders this week introduced a bill that would shorten the standard work week to 32 hours. Sanders contends that U.S. companies can afford to give employees more time off without pay or benefit cuts because of advancements in automation, robotics, and AI. Detractors say shorter weeks would force companies to hire additional workers or lose productivity. According to the bill, employers couldn't cut pay or benefits to match the lost hours. In the highly unlikely event that this bill passes, labor reductions would happen over the next 4 years. By now, most have heard about the British study that found that employees came to work less stressed and actually more focused while revenues remained steady or increased. A 32-hour work week might work for those behind a desk, but it could spell disaster for manufacturing plants that need laborers to keep assembly lines running. So, Anna, does this just mean one more day of overtime or an extra day in the weekend in the event, the highly unlikely event that this were to pass?
Yeah, very, very unlikely. And I don't even think this is a proposal that we need to be taking at face value.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't think that Sanders is genuine in his push for this. I do think he is, but I think he knows that it's a non-starter. But it does continue to keep this concept alive and in the public eye. You know, kind of ask for more than you want kind of a strategy there. But we know that Bernie's always been pro-worker person. This is clearly a pro-worker bill. But the timing of it is not great for what it, you know, what it maintains here. Businesses across the country are already being stymied by a lack of workers. They're saying that it's hampering their ability to grow. We've seen data on that. That's true. Yeah. And you know that if this were to proceed, there will be plenty of workers that, you know, to your point, wouldn't take the overtime. They'd take the day, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you wouldn't begrudge them that. But as the article points out, there are roles like those in manufacturing where less hands-on really means less productivity. And to extrapolate that across other roles, you know, many jobs with hourly pay, like trades, you know, they take the time that they take. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like you can just fit 40 hours of electrical work into 32.
Yeah, it takes X amount of time to put an outlet in a hole.
Exactly. So I do think that in certain industries, this would add to the worker problem that these companies are already facing. That said, Bernie Sanders is not wrong. The advancement in efficiency via automation and technology means workers today are vastly more productive than they were, you know, decades ago. That said, you are not going to get buy-in from the companies and their elected officials mm-hmm. on scaling back the related revenues that they have derived from that increase in efficiency. What he can do, I think, is keep the concept in the media, continue to deliver the data behind it, make it an ongoing conversation about what workers deserve from a pay and a quality of life standpoint, really.
Yeah.
Especially when there's an opportunity for companies to initiate their own programs along these lines voluntarily to sort of gain a competitive advantage in that talent acquisition conundrum and really also support their productivity goals. So if anything comes from it, it is that. You know, I don't think this is going to happen through a legislative process, but maybe it keeps this idea out there. And, you know, some executives are seeing this and thinking, well, maybe I can offer something to my employees to get these talented people to come work for me and stay.
Well, if anything, if it having it in the conversation makes it a little bit more accepted for future generations, I understand it. Because when our generation reads a headline like this, like, we don't even comprehend it or entertain the idea of it because the thought of it is such an impossibility, right? Like, it's just like, oh man, a 3-day weekend, like every week? Huh? Nah.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know. I think that's where a lot of that pushback comes from, Jeff, is just like, hey, we've been working 40s since what, the 30s? It's hard for people to fathom such a paradigm shift.
It is, but I agree with Bernie Sanders on one thing. Probably this is it. I mean, quite honestly, but it is good that this conversation is continuing to move forward because we are finding more and more support for these types of initiatives. Now, look at this from two perspectives. The macro perspective, to enforce this across the U.S. as a law into so many different industries, I mean, how do you handle healthcare workers that are hourly? How do you handle financial? I mean, there'd be so many things that would need to get figured out before this could become any type of reality universally.
Yeah.
That it's probably too big to even really think about seriously at this point. But if we look at it from a manufacturing perspective specifically, I think it is very interesting because we could see a lot of those benefits in terms of just the first thing I thought of was just mental health.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. In terms of people, we can all point to different individuals who just get fatigued.
Yeah, and burnout is real, man.
Affects decision making. And obviously we're going to be talking about Boeing in a little bit there. You know, I think they could make some arguments for the way they're managing their workforce potentially at times.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things there. But the two things that came up with, to my mind, specifically for manufacturing, are first of all, wouldn't this just promote or encourage a lot of manufacturers to make their employees salaried as opposed to hourly?
Yeah.
Because that's the first thing I would do personally. If I was running a small business and I had work that needed to get done, I would make that move. Now, that's going to cost you a little bit in terms of other benefits that go along with salary positions typically, mm-hmm. but there'd be some adjustments there. And then how would people react to that? Because there's a lot of, especially when you get into the trades and things like that, those folks don't want a salary. They want to be working on an hourly basis.
Yeah.
Then when you get into project management type situations, if you're building, constructing, you have deadlines, you going to let your workforce go at 32 hours? Or how is that going to work? There's going to be overtime costs, which then lead into higher project costs. And how does that affect bottom line? So there's so many other factors. But the other thing that's interesting too is if that is a dynamic or a potential causality of going to a 32-hour work week, how do the unions feel about that? Because they're not going to get paid a 32-hour wage or, excuse me, a 40-hour wage working 32 hours. And if the company doesn't want to pay overtime and they start salarying these folks, how does the UAW or the Teamsters feel about that type of shift or that type of dynamic? So you've got Bernie Sanders, who is very much a social Democrat. I didn't call him a socialist, Anna.
Yeah.
Social Democrat, very much dependent on support from unions. How would they react to some of these things that the 32-hour work week might institute? I think it'd be a lot of interesting sort of cultural shifts beyond what we can just think about from an operational perspective in manufacturing. So I think it is a good conversation to continue to have for all the reasons that we talked about. But it would be more monumental, I think, than we even can realize sometimes.
Well, I think policing it might not be as hard as we would think, because we police 40-hour work weeks. We just have to change that standard, right? And I also think that, you know, part of the law as it's written now is that it would be illegal for them to pull, like, claw back wages. So, you know, that could be part of the union's defense. It's just like, hey, it's flat illegal that we're working 32s now. We're still negotiating them as it's a 40, right? Like, but so I think it could work in specific cases. And we've talked about them, right? We talked about the custom RV manufacturer where it worked. And, you know, given the nature of the work, they could work 4 days a week, get the same amount done. You know, the boss admitted, like, hey, we could be more profitable, but it's a quality of life. And that's what he chose for his workers. So, but I do, like Anna, you kind of mentioned, I truly think this could be a differentiator for companies that are combating staffing problems. And for those that are having problems right now, what's the harm in, like, testing this theory? You know, I get that a lot of companies join the study just to kind of see what would happen. But, like, you know, you could take a sample size, you could take a division, you could take a part of your business and experiment with this just to see, you know, do you experience productivity increases? Do you experience, like, employee morale increases? Like, I don't know. I think that as we're trying to face this ongoing skill shortage and labor problem, like, I mean, we've seen people get pretty creative.
Mm-hmm. It's another idea. Yeah.
Or just even asking employees, you know, just like, hey, would you buy in? Would you try this? It, like, earnestly, you know, like, or would you just, like, have 4 days?
I mean, I think the initial thoughts are, yeah, four-day work week is awesome until you realize you're only getting paid for 32 hours instead of 40.
Yeah.
That's, I think.
No, but you'd be paid for 40. But you would be paid for 40. Like, so your salary wouldn't change.
But if you're an hourly worker, so then you're going to get an hourly increase.
Yeah.
But then that's going to affect how much you're paid for overtime as well, right?
I believe so, yeah. Or no, because overtime would still be, like, what, time and a half or double time?
Right, but if you have to get a 32-hour work paid for 40 hours at 32 hours, your hourly rate is going to increase.
Correct.
But then that's also going to increase your overtime pay as well.
Yeah. Oh, so you're saying like they'd still work 40s? Because in the end,
well,
end
potentially,
of the day,
I'm just saying that's what makes it harder for a manufacturer to want to institute if they're regulated in that fashion.
Yeah.
Where, okay, not only am I going to have to pay them more for the 32 hours, but then I'm going to have to pay them more if we do need them to work overtime.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's a tough pill to swallow.
Those costs could escalate dramatically. For me, at the end of the day, I think GOP Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana was correct when he says that paying workers the same wages for fewer hours would force employees or employers to pass the cost of hiring more workers along to consumers. And I mean, just because we've seen every cost passed on to consumers lately.
No one's shy about doing that.
Including like hidden or imaginative ones. It also kind of flagged a story that I saw at the AI Safety Summit in the UK back in November. Elon Musk discussed a potential future where AI renders traditional employment obsolete, but provides a, quote, age of abundance through a system of universal high income. So we've talked about people discussing universal basic income, but it would be a universal high income to, you know, just to have a higher standard of life, quality of life. Musk said, it's hard to say exactly what the moment is, but there will come a point where no job is needed. You can have a job if you want to have a job or sort of personal satisfaction, but the AI will be able to do everything. And this was according to a Benzinga article. And I just thought, like, you know, shorter work weeks might be a bridge to this, like, I mean, you can call it dystopian. You can call it age of abundance, depending on what angle you look at it, where people don't need to work anymore. But like, I don't know. It just made me think like we're on this trajectory of like working less, relying more on technology. And in case you missed it, is going to kind of focus on that too. So I'm just kind of like, you know, setting the table. Setting the table. But Jeff, what do you think about a universal high income?
I think that's great to think about, but there's always going to be economic factors like inflation that are going to tie into that and sort of balance it out. In other words, people are always going to charge for a product or service, whatever they can. And if AI is doing it, you still need somebody to feed the AI or there's still some mechanism of work that would seem to be need to be done and covered. The other part of that just defies not every human being, but the overall general human spirit of just being alive. You know, if you're going to get up in the morning, you're going to do something productive.
We're going to garden.
Okay, fair enough. But that's still work, right? I mean, there's still going to be a job being done in some way, shape, or form. So I guess I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that as far as everybody embracing it. There are some who would definitely be totally cool with just – I think overall that'd be a tough one for everyone to get on board with.
Not quiet quitting anymore. It's just flat quitting.
Just done.
Everyone done. Yeah. And also, Anna, if it's a universal high income, isn't that if everyone's on a universal high income, isn't that just universal basic income? But it's higher.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Future's gonna be wild, man. Last week, insurance obsolete. This week, all work.
Everything.
Gone.
Everyone. Yeah. And then like as soon as someone needs to like fix the robot, they're like, no one knows how to do it.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's straight up.
I'm not doing that.
it's straight up Wall-E where like humans don't even have bones anymore because they don't move.
Right.
Just like, I can't wait to have my floating pod. Okay. Our next most popular story this week. Unilever to cut 7,500 jobs. Unilever, a company of 400 brands, is trying to cut costs and boost profits. So on Tuesday, it announced 7,500 job cuts. The company will also spin off its ice cream business, which includes Ben & Jerry's ice cream. As for the spinoff, the London-based behemoth called the business, quote, distinct, and said it would benefit from separate ownership to increase growth. The breakup could be done as soon as late 2025. Unilever has 128,000 employees and is launching a, quote, productivity program that's going to help cull 7,500 mostly office workers. The company will leverage technology to find efficiencies and other duplications that will help save nearly $1 billion over the next 3 years. So, what's the problem here? Unilever's sales volume dropped 3.6% in 2022, but only after raising prices 13.3% on average across all brands. Last year, prices still went up another 2.8%. Unilever's CEO said, and this has been coming up a lot in the things we've been talking about, it's time to simplify the portfolio. As for Ben & Jerry's, Russ Mould from financial services bureau AJ Belwich told the AP the spinoff could help quell cries over, quote, go woke and go broke following the ice cream brand's social activism. Anna, there is a lot to unpack with this entire announcement, but what are your thoughts on Unilever saying it's going to lean on technology to find inefficiencies and duplications? To me, that just says, like, we're going to use AI to do everything, HR, marketing, you know, just straight across the board, as well as parting ways with probably Ben & Jerry's and then all the rest of the ice cream brands to make sure it doesn't look like they're just cutting Ben & Jerry's.
Oh, they're just cutting Ben & Jerry's. That's clear, I think.
Yeah.
It's become a problem category for them and they're cutting loose, which anyway, yeah, I love how they just refer to office workers. Like, what do they even do? Yeah. You know, they're just sitting at their cubes, playing the little pool table.
Yeah, just walking cube to cube, chit-chatting for 8 hours.
Chit-chatting and telling jokes at the water cooler and raking their sand.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they do. Yep. Yeah. Just replace them with AI, man. No, everybody wants to drag Bernie Sanders for stuff like we just went over in the previous story. But this story is also a great example of how companies will shout from the rooftops about how important their culture is and their employees, and we have second to none workers and talent. And then in a second, just dump them when they feel the pinch and they need to improve their margins. And in the company's first half earnings call, Unilever's CEO, Hein Schumacher, said the company's performance highlighted the support of its team of talented people. That was not very long ago. That was just a couple months ago.
Yeah.
You know, you can't fault a company for wanting to run as efficiently as possible, wanting to reduce redundancies, add technology, all of that, totally normal. But these types of announcements, I think, tend to be tied and timed with a need for maintaining growth targets. And maybe, as we've discussed before, growth targets and profit margins aren't supposed to be consistently double digit like we saw coming out of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And Unilever's net profit fell 13.7% in 2023, but it was still 7 billion euros.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
Not bad.
Pre-pandemic in 2019, it was 6.3 billion. So this is not a bad year, you know? To me, it seems like corporate boards and shareholders they got a taste for a certain level of growth rate, which was arguably in the food sector at least propped up by maybe over-aggressive price increases, overshooting that and blaming inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe now there's no going back. You know, it seems like it's like the shareholders got a taste for this, and then they're like, figure it out. This is what we want. And these companies are doing it. But, you know, we've seen time after time companies say, we have to cut back because our profits are down.
Mm-hmm.
But 2023 profits being down from record high profits in 2022, they should be down, you know, like we have already talked about. This is not a sustainable level of growth that we saw coming out of the pandemic. And unfortunately for these workers, I think they're just getting swept up in this. We have to make more money always, even though that's sort of a conspicuous claim based on the circumstances of the year prior.
And I think it is going to reach a breaking point. I mean, you are not going to be able to keep cutting to make aggressive goals in terms of earnings and keeping shareholders happy. There will be a breaking point at some point. And I'm curious to see when that happens, because I think with people basing targets off of record highs, like, it's going to come pretty swiftly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just in my opinion.
David, that's how CEOs get fired.
Yeah.
Okay, there is no breaking point. If you're a shareholder, they don't care.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but it's like, but we see it. It's so cyclical how we see it. We're like, they push until it breaks. They blame the fall guy. Give him the golden parachute. Bring in the guy to fix it. Doesn't fix it well enough. Give him the golden parachute. And then slowly build up again until they do it all over again.
Well, that's the nature of these consumer product goods, these consumer packaged goods companies, these CPG folks. I mean, we've talked about this before. The margins on their products are not high.
Yeah. Okay.
They're selling for pennies on the dollar. That's just the way it is. They're also in very mature product categories. So how does a CPG make more money? New products, which is tough right now because, again, very mature when you look at health and beauty, household goods, things like that. Raise prices, which they tried, didn't work out great. Or you have to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, how are you going to buy stuff when your profits aren't increasing? Because the shareholders still want what they want, what they want, what they want, and they want it right now. So this becomes this constant ongoing battle, especially now. I think we talked about Tyson last week, you know, basically shuttering a plant because sales were down and because their stock prices were down. Same dynamic here. That's what it is all about. It all is all about the stock price because financially speaking, the company is still very healthy. Mm-hmm. But when you get into, again, very tight product group, very difficult to grow these types of companies, you have limited options. And this is how it's going to continue to go as far as breaking point. Again, if this guy doesn't deliver, they'll find somebody else. They'll continue to cut. I think it's very interesting that they called it a productivity program. I mean, those always kind of bother me because shouldn't you grow productivity, like grow in a productive way as opposed to having to cut people?
Yeah.
And I think it's because we've always been in very lean running organizations. Mm-hmm. So that whole concept is difficult to understand. But we've also seen other companies where a 10 to 25% headcount reduction is not going to impact how they function.
Yeah, it might actually be helpful.
And here, I don't know enough to see what kind of positions they're going to be eliminating. We're looking at roughly 5% of their global workforce, but they're only looking at the white-collar workers. I don't know. Yeah. But if this is what they're going to – if this is the only thing they've got left, I think that is kind of a red alert going off here a little bit. If the only way you have to grow your profitability is to cut jobs – where's the innovation coming from? Mm-hmm. What are you doing to really show that investment in your company? Because the only thing you've tried so far, according to what we've seen, is increased prices.
Yeah.
Try launching some new stuff. And maybe don't alienate one of your golden goose here with Ben and Jerry's.
Well, and not only there's just so many things that are like, one, the productivity program to me is an efficiency program. And it's kind of how everyone is racing to figure out how they can implement AI to save on costs. And this just screams to me like, no. We can replace all these people with bots and we should be fine. And who knows? Maybe there will be. But also, maybe they won't. And when you talk about like low margin, I get it when we're talking about like chicken or when we're talking about things where maybe the margins are a little tighter. But like, has anyone bought Ben and Jerry's lately? Like those margins are pretty healthy compared to any sort of generic alternative or really any other alternative out there. Like Ben and Jerry's doing fine. Some of their other stuff acts. I mean, when you look at their brands, Dove, Hellman's, like these are brands that sustain, like that have like healthy margins right now.
They do, but they're also under, and we've talked about this before too, increased competition from generics, store brands, things of that nature. And there's not a lot of room for them to introduce a lower cost alternative because that's who they're fighting against.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of these folks come out post pandemic. They were riding this high because demand was surging. They could charge whatever they wanted to basically because people were spending. And now that's scaled back. And now people are looking more closely at that. And once you lose a customer, we talk about this all the time, it's pretty tough to get them back, especially if they see that lower cost item. It does the job pretty well.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they're dealing with here as well.
Well, they should stop shrinkflating my mayo, all right? Stop shrinkflating my mayo, all right? I know, I can tell because that mayo has had the same size slot on the shelf for years, and now there's a little bit of padding in between these products. You know, you can notice it.
Yeah.
So, Anna, what do you think about them divesting of, like, Ben & Jerry's? And so Ben & Jerry's is still the leading ice cream brand in the United States. This new ice cream company, which they haven't named yet, so we're just going to call it Ice Cream Company X, I guess. Something really innovative. You know, they have 5 of the 10 best-selling ice cream brands in the world. Magnum, Ben & Jerry's, and Breyers are 3 of them. And Unilever's ice cream division did $8.6 billion in sales last year. I mean, that's bigger than the 4 closest competitors combined. So they're willing to, like, they want to get rid of this division, spin it off, just because it's, like, a nuisance, a thorn in the side? Like, that just, to me, I was like, I didn't understand that.
Well, I mean, Ben & Jerry's has been, you know, the product of some controversial statements, I think, and political positions. And so maybe Unilever just wants to get out of that. You know, yeah. It seems like I get that. I can also see, like, looking at some of the volatility with materials for dairy and things like that, that's also maybe another factor going into this, wanting to get out of this business. But I don't think it's that hard to believe, honestly, that, I mean, there were
just sick of fielding calls.
Kind of. I mean, there have been boycotts and things, you know, maybe this is better to be, it's probably been some pressure from stockholders and the board and, you know, like maybe this is better privately owned. I don't know. It just, Unilever has a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah.
And so I could see them being like, you know what, this is just taking up too much of our time. It's too much pressure. We don't know what the swings are going to be.
Yeah.
It's harder to manage that brand.
I can't stand that they're using the excuse of go woke and go broke. And Ben & Jerry's is still like the leading ice cream brand by like a mile.
Yeah, I'm not even going to get going on that one.
Okay.
I think one of the things too, I think Anna kind of hit it on the head. There was a different cultural clash here between these two entities.
Yeah.
Unilever is always seen as sort of a safe harbor from a stock perspective, which again, that's what's driving all of this. It's stock price and shareholder input. So I think they probably embraced or championed the idea of letting Ben & Jerry's go their own way.
Did they say, is this new company, is it going to be private or is it going to be a public company?
I don't know.
Because I'm interested to see what happens with this just because based on the portfolio, it's going to be a banger of a ice cream company. All right. Our next most popular story this week. Boeing tells airlines to check pilot seats after report that accidental shift led plane to plunge. Oh, Boeing. This week, the plane maker is telling airlines to inspect switches on pilot seats on the 787 Dreamliner. The direction comes after a report that said an accidental cockpit seat movement likely caused a LATAM Airlines plane to suddenly plunge. But not right away. Boeing says to check out the seats the next time they perform maintenance. Not an emergency. Next time you get around to it, just, you know, put your head under there, check out that seat's motor. The Wall Street Journal says a flight attendant was serving a meal in the cockpit when she hit a switch on the back of a seat that pushed the pilot into the controls and then pushed the nose of the plane down. Boeing says this is a, quote, precautionary measure and didn't say it was because of the LATAM report. The FAA disagreed and directly said it was, quote, in response to the incident on LATAM Flight 800. About 50 people were injured. Now, Jeff, more than ever, keep those seat belts on unless you are moving about the cabin.
Yeah. Another reason I don't miss flying as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I miss that travel. You know, it's interesting with this story because once you dig into it a little bit, it's kind of one of those things that can just happen. Like it was an oversight. You don't want it to. It's obviously elevated because of where it happened and all of that. But really, a lot of this stuff that we've been covering on Boeing right now, to me anyway, it feels like this is getting taken to a higher place. It's getting more attention, more scrutiny, more attention just because it's Boeing. Mm-hmm. And they've had stuff, you know, like planes crash and a door fly off. Okay. That's going to lead to a lot more focus on a lot more little things. The reality is if you look at FAA investigations over the last month, Boeing has had 18 of these. Airbus has had about 15. And there is twice as many complaints that are non-Boeing as Boeing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all of it is stuff similar to this. Smoke in the cabinet, lights going on that shouldn't, hydraulics issues. These are things that happen on a regular basis, but get more attention right now if you're Boeing because of all that other stuff. So again, when it comes to paying attention to all those little things, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, this is what happens when you don't. And then something big happens and all this stuff gets, pardon the term, blown up and made into a bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I will never understand when it comes to certain organizations, why companies try to like fight against it or whatever you want to say, as opposed to going to the flow.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to something from OSHA, NHTSA, NTSB, FAA, just go with it. You're not going to win this fight, and you're going to look like a jerk because you're going against an organization that is set up for no other reason than to ensure the consumer is safe.
Yeah.
There is no way you coming out and sort of being competitive and saying, this had nothing to do with the FAA investigation. This is on our thing. We're just, you know, it just happened to coincide with this happening. It's not related. And then the FAA comes out and says, yeah, it's exactly because we told them to, because this happened. Don't do that. That's that whole Elon Musk strategy that makes him look like a jerk, and it makes you look like a jerk as well.
Well, it's just, it's become a pattern of behavior for Boeing. And like, I mean, this is a freak accident, but the freak accidents are starting to pile up. And where we have, it's crazy to me that there have been oversights with these types of things.
But that's my point.
Yeah.
This is getting more scrutiny now because of the bigger stuff.
Yeah.
Airbus has the same issues. There's a lot of these smaller passenger planes. There are huge safety concerns for. Planes are crashing right now and people are dying.
Yeah.
We're not paying attention to that stuff.
Yeah.
We're focused on Boeing. I understand the scale is different.
Yeah.
Obviously, 300 people on a plane, different than two or three. I get all that. But there's still a lot of other stuff that the FAA is looking at. And there's a lot of safety concerns that are non-Boeing.
Yeah.
Nobody's paying attention to that right now.
No, but I think that was part of the problem is that like Boeing wasn't under a microscope at all. I mean, I don't even know that they were getting glanced at that often. But now the scrutiny is on, and it's really showing that it's really showing what Boeing is, warts and all.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeff, you raise a good point. I would counter at least, though, to say that smaller planes like Cessnas and stuff, they're responsible for the vast majority of fatal air accidents. And those planes crash every single day. And no one has ever paid attention to that. That's like, you know, that's not new to this context. It's not. It's just it's always been that way. I don't know why. Because you can decide to not get in it, I guess.
Right.
But I don't know. This like death by a thousand cuts for Boeing thing is actually making me nervous as an occasional flyer. Like I'm kind of to the point where I'm not wanting to fly. Because every day it seems like there's another thing about a crack or something dripping or breaking or missing. I don't know. And you know, already there's a lot of people out there that have a fear of flying. So you kind of wonder what happens now. Like I saw there was an AP NORC poll issued in early February, which was right after the Alaska Airlines incident with the plug blowout. But also before a lot of these more recent incidents have occurred, it revealed that only 2 in 10 U.S. adults have a great deal of confidence that airplanes are being properly maintained or that they are safe from structural defects. It stands to reason that that may be eroding a bit since, because, again, you know, whether it's fair, the media coverage has been relentless on this stuff. So every single day, you see something. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, United, who carries a fleet that's more than 3/4 Boeing planes, is taking a huge reputation hit right now because of this and these repeated incidents. And when you see headlines like what's going on with United, you think, well, what's going on with Boeing?
Yeah.
And if Boeing's problems are going to take a brand down like United, then the idea of this, I think, upends the concept that the entire industry can be basically supported by just two vendors. And to me, that begs the question, what is there to be done about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's far easier to put Band-Aids on Boeing than it is to find someone to take their place in the commercial sector. So you wonder, will the FAA do exactly that? Will they continue with their mandates and inspections and sanctions and then kind of let it blow over so we can move on? Because that's kind of what happened with the MAX. You know, they made some changes, but obviously if you look at how terrible their manufacturing processes allegedly are just several years later, on top of that, I don't think they made enough changes.
Right.
And you kind of wonder how much appetite the consumer has for this cycle. So it's a scary prospect to think, like, if Boeing were out of the picture, what would we do? Well, flight costs would go up tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be beholden to just an Airbus? Probably not. That's a monopoly. So then you're dealing with, like, are these other entities that make planes for the military going to come in and do commercial? They don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's like it is a can of worms to let Boeing go away. You can't, you know, so like the FAA has a vested interest, I think, in making sure that Boeing survives this scandal. And so I don't know. Are they going to survive it enough to make the willing public feel comfortable getting on a commercial airplane? I don't know.
You know what's crazy? And actually, it's, you guys would probably be disgusted just because I bring it up, but like this seems like an opportunity in the market where traditionally someone like, I don't know, an Elon Musk type would launch a commercial aerospace competitor. Or I don't know. I just think that right now, if you have an idea as to how you could maybe make a better aircraft, now might be a good time to try and enter the picture.
Well, I mean, then you're looking at, excuse me, you're looking at an aerospace defense type of contractor. You're looking at Lockheed Martin. You're looking at Northrop Grumman. And they have a vested interest not to do that.
Yes, no, completely understood. Like, I'm not talking about the military contractors coming to the commercial side. I'm talking about, like, essentially what
SpaceX
would be...
SpaceX commercial?
Yeah, SpaceX commercial.
Not getting
Tesla.
On that plane.
Yeah, Tesla planes. Yeah. No, but I'm not... I'm just... I'm using him as an example. Or, like, you know, Bezos airplanes. You know, someone that has deep pockets that could potentially disrupt the industry just because the quality problems are piling up, man.
But see, here's my point, though. Those quality problems have always been there. They are continued. This is just an ongoing issue. A dozen of those same complaints in the last month, those were Airbus planes. The same type of stuff we're covering for Boeing, it doesn't get the scrutiny right now because of all the other stuff. So I understand the whole death by a thousand cuts, but that's almost like being a passenger airline, plane provider.
Yeah.
Like that is the business. It's getting more scrutiny right now. Or Boeing's feeling the more bigger brunt of it because of all that other stuff. My point was, this is always happening. Like this is always ongoing. All of these little things are always happening. The FAA has 57 different investigations started in the past month.
Yeah.
Okay. And 30 or more of them are those two big guys.
Yeah. I would say yes and no to that. I would say that we have seen the problems with Boeing surface as a result of cutting costs internally, an over-reliance on suppliers that aren't complying with their specifications, and that's causing quality problems. They're also trying to rush these things out the door. That's causing quality problems. Like it's no longer like the old way of making a plane was quality over quantity, and now under this new leadership, it seems to be quantity over quality. And you're right. When you talk about some of those stories like the plane that took off, that lost a tire, that's like a 20-year-old plane, right? That's getting scrutiny because it's a Boeing-made plane. You know, like you got to read to the third sentence to understand like, oh, okay, it's a Boeing plane that's like almost as old as me. And hey, things are starting to fall apart, you know? So I get that. But I do think that you can look at the current state of Boeing and they have made specific choices that have caused quality problems internally. Okay. Also, was anyone else concerned that the fix is just to disable this feature? Like,
I guess the way I understood it is basically the switch should only be on if you're doing some sort of work on that seat or on that electrical feature.
Okay,
it should always be off, but something was going on that it was flipped on. It's always supposed to be off.
Always supposed to be off. See, I was reading it as like, it was like, you know, the side on the car where you can slide it forward, you know, in terms of the pilot getting comfortable. So we talked, I think last week, we talked about Boeing buying Spirit, right? Spirit mm-hmm. Aerosystems. Well, so now Boeing is trying to see if and how Spirit can sever ties with the part of the business that supplies key Airbus components. If that happens, it'll be intriguing to see whether Boeing or Airbus can heal Spirit faster. And I think that could be like a real good indicator as to who has a healthier company, you know, just because it's like, hey, both of you guys get a piece of something that's broken, fix it, you know, because you're both wholly dependent on its survival. Some of the Airbus components are custom made using proprietary design and technology. And I mean, another thing is it's going to be hard to safeguard against exposing that IP to Boeing. Like, do you ever see like there being a clean break in Spirit where everyone that knows the intellectual property about Airbus goes one way and everyone else is just like, I had no idea what they were doing over there?
Well, Airbus has a much lower percentage of their stuff made there than Boeing.
It's it was 20%. So okay. Like Airbus is 20% of Spirit's revenue last year.
Yeah. So, I mean, however they're managing that now, you would, I guess, assume it would continue in that respect. I don't know if you could split them up, because I'm sure there's, you know, some efficiencies that are garnered from working with both in terms of whether it's, you know, manpower, materials, all that kind of stuff. It would be interesting to see Airbus sort of swoop in potentially and do that instead of Boeing. I don't know how that would work out, but
I think it would have to be the same, right? For regulators, they'd have to, I mean, essentially they're getting, basically they're trying to get ahead of regulators with this, which is like, hey, we're going to buy you. This is going to be a problem. Get rid of it. And also, like, according to some insiders, a Reuters report said that Boeing doesn't want this Airbus business. I mean, you know, because like there's a plant in Belfast that makes wings for the A220, which loses money. Spirit has already thrown out feelers to see if Airbus would take that plant off their hands. So I think there are a lot of pieces moving behind the scenes, and I'm really curious to see what becomes of Spirit.
See, I mean, you're talking about, you know, somebody with deep pockets swooping in and trying to start a new airline or aircraft manufacturer. This would be more, make more sense to me if you did see, you know, a Lockheed or somebody like that buy Spirit.
Yeah.
Like that would make more sense in terms of maybe trying to get their, you know, getting up to their elbow on the commercial side as opposed to, and diversify away from just the defense.
True. Cause you know that. You know that sales are there. Like,
well, and they know how to make planes. You know, if we talk about making a car is hard, making a plane's really hard.
I don't know. It's
I think it is, David.
Not
true. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say it's really hard to make a plane.
I don't know. I'm going the other way. You're like, I made an airplane. Well, I made a paper airplane once. It's pretty easy.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, I mean,
they do have kits for those eVTOL things that you're fine with, no matter how unsafe they are.
Yeah, no, it's something about buying a plane kit off the internet, building it in my garage where I don't feel confident.
Yeah,
Jeff, I don't feel confident. David's baiting you right now because he knows that you said you would be nice, so he's like, I could make an airplane.
That's not
Jeff.
See, that's not.
What
baiting.
Do you think about that,
David? No matter how much it was tilting in one way and looked like it was glued together, I wouldn't tell you.
You would just say, good job, little buddy.
You did it. Man, that plane nearly went 2 feet before it smashed into the ground.
I'm going to put this on my desk at work.
Our next most popular story. Ford pays $365 million to resolve trade fraud allegations. Ford last week agreed to pay the United States government $365 million to take care of allegations of Tariff Act violations. It is one of the largest customs penalties in recent history. According to the DOJ, Ford misclassified and understated the value of hundreds of thousands of its transit cargo vans. The U.S. imposes a 25% duty rate on vehicles classified as, quote, motor vehicles for the transport of goods. There is also a 2.5% duty rate for vehicles, quote, principally designed for the transport of persons. From 2009 to 2013, Ford allegedly tried to avoid the duty rate by disguising cargo vans imported from Turkey as passenger vehicles with fake rear seats. These back seats lacked headrests and weren't covered, or they were covered in a cheap fabric that didn't even match the front seats. They also lacked side airbags, speakers, handholds, and vents behind the front seats. Other red flags, the rear doors were designed for cargo loading, and there was an exposed metal floor in the back. Once the vehicles cleared customs, the DOJ says Ford removed the seats and lifted the thin veil on the two-seat cargo vans. Nolan Beilstein, who put the story together, reached out to Ford, which, quote, strongly disagrees with many of the characterizations in the DOJ's statement and admits no liability. In the interest of moving on with this from this complex decade-old dispute, we have agreed to settle this matter once and for all. That's it, Anna. Hands clean. Yep. Just, we're going to simply pay the biggest customs fine in recent history. And I'm pretty sure we can all agree no one's at fault here. Yeah. Move on. Yeah. I can't believe no one flagged the milk crates in back prior. Like, I just imagine that this is, you know, they put like an old white t-shirt over a couple of milk crates and they're like, no, that's a back seat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I'm glad that Ford came out with a statement on this, but I would have loved some more detail into like what the characterizations were that they vehemently disagree with. You know, obviously cheap fabric is not a crime. You can have, not that you didn't do anything wrong necessarily there, but why don't they have vents and airbags for these seats? That would be incredibly uncommon for passenger seating. So why not address that part?
Yeah. Headrests. I mean, every passenger, as far as I know, has a head.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, to the best of my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Safe bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It appears to me that Ford is getting caught red-handed here and with a clear motive as well, 25% versus 2.5% duty. That would motivate any company, I think, to manipulate. And they do. My guess here is that Ford wants to move on, I think, in part because they got a mere fraction of the financial penalty that they could have gotten.
Yeah.
In 2021, there were reports saying that Ford could expect something in the $1.3 billion range.
Yeah.
As far as import penalties, and, you know, at the time, Ford was contending that while unorthodox, these back seats had seat belts and were street legal. So they were viewed as passenger vehicles for that reason. The problem was that that's not how they were marketing them to consumers. So I think the concern now with Ford settling is that the SEC could potentially go after other automakers who do a variation of this. And you guys are familiar with like what a chicken tax is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's common in automotive for companies to try to avoid some of these tariffs by partially building, almost building a vehicle, exporting it to the US, and then final assembly is, I don't know, slapping a sticker on the back or whatever. Mm-hmm. but it's basically that same idea. You know, I think the writing on the wall is potentially, does the SEC or the DOJ go after some of the other big three automakers for these same practices and try to apply retroactive tariffs to them and use this now as precedent for that? So it's potential that there could be some wider implications here that rope in some of the other big players in automotive, but that remains to be seen.
Well, and it wasn't just reported. Like Ford put it in an SEC filing that they faced penalties up to $1.3 billion. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, hey, we didn't do anything. We certainly didn't do anything. But in the event that these guys don't agree with us, we could really be on the hook here.
Yeah.
And Anna, for the people listening at home, and I mean, maybe myself, what is a chicken tax?
It's basically like there's like a backstory about like how it applies, like some story with like frozen chickens or how they're prepared, correct?
Well, it where I reference, maybe there's more to it, but what I referenced was in, I think it was 64, Lyndon Johnson instituted a tax to basically refute a tariff that was being placed against chickens that the U.S. was trying to import into other markets, particularly, I believe it was Germany and France. And basically, those countries just skyrocketed the tariffs.
Oh, okay.
And in response to that, Johnson said, okay, if you're going to do that to something like chicken, something like that, then we're going to do the same thing for any type of trucks that are coming in. So it became known as the chicken tax because what it did is it artificially inflated the advantage for U.S. manufacturers in light trucks. And basically they've held on to that ever since.
Yeah.
So to import trucks into the U.S., they get hit with the same 25% tax that's not made here. So that's where that whole chicken tax came from.
That's
so
like straight Cold War politics.
It is. I didn't know the exact reasoning as to why it was called that, but ultimately now the automakers try to take advantage of that by like, you know, shipping incomplete products. And it's been like a point of contention for many years as to what they're doing there. So,
well, and the other point of this is that like Ford didn't just want to settle this because, you know what? It's been so long. Let's get it off our plate, right? They fought the claims, arguing that the tariffs applied to vehicles based on their condition upon importation, not later modifications. They even took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which refused to hear it. And you know what? Then they're like, you know what? I think we might need to settle this because the highest court said no. And of the $365 million settlement, did you guys want to guess as to how much of it goes to lost import duties and other penalties? How much of that penalty, like what they would have paid? $183,000.
What?
That's what, according to the Detroit Free Press, like that's what they would have paid in duties. And like everything else was a penalty.
25% of each. Well, I guess it's raw costs. It's not selling costs, right? So I don't know. That seems low though.
Yeah. I guess I'm not a math guy. unlike you.
Yeah.
I know. But, see, and as a dedicated math guy, yeah. I read the math somebody else did, and it checked out.
Yeah, we should definitely rely on David for this.
What did Henry refer to you as, beautiful mind, last week?
Goodwill Hunting. Goodwill Hunting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But beautiful mind, I'll take that one too. You know, I'm really good with yarn and thread. Jeff, what were your thoughts on the penalty that Ford paid? And I mean, really kind of this fight just running out of steam.
Well, I think this is interesting because when you start digging into sort of the legacy of this whole, these tariffs, plus, can I just say, every time you guys said duty, I laughed a little bit inside.
I mean, Jeff.
Real mature.
Yeah. Yep.
Got okay. a lot of.
Yeah, that's what, I'll take her side. Yeah, yeah. Jeff. How dare you?
That was funny.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alex.
Everyone's giggling.
So the Tariff Act that they're looking at, the Tariff Act of 1930, it's also kind of interesting when you look back at this because that was originally set up to help farmers during the Depression. Basically, any imported agricultural products were taxed very heavily so that people, consumers, would lean more towards U.S.-based goods and was supposed to help farmers out. Over time, obviously, that's been manipulated to where it is now. Because mm-hmm. my first thought when I looked at this is why would the U.S. charge a U.S. manufacturer 25% to sell their products in this country? Mm-hmm. That didn't make sense to me until you start looking into the way that tariff, that act has changed over time. When you look at the chicken tax stuff that we just talked about, which basically insulated U.S. The OEs for such a long time in terms of not having to deal with the same pricing structure that foreign manufacturers did to get their products here. So it gave them a huge advantage for 30 plus years until Toyota and everybody else started building stuff here. Mm-hmm. And you can also see the benefit to that tariff then in terms of improving U.S. manufacturing. So we don't want Ford making stuff. I think these came from Turkey or wherever it was. Mm-hmm. We want them making it here. Then you start throwing in stuff like NAFTA and everything else. And this just gets so convoluted because the OEs, even though in this situation Ford is out $300 million, there's just this legacy where they have benefited from a lot of these different legislative tariff-focused pieces of regulation for so long. And it just gets – it's so sticky and so convoluted in terms of how sometimes they win and sometimes they lose, and you just end up rolling with it. I think the best approach, when you look at an article that Mike Collins actually wrote for us back in December where he talked about all of these tariffs and free trade agreements, how it hasn't worked in the past – and how basically we need to start sticking up for U.S. products, stuff made here, even more strongly than we currently are. If we really want to grow manufacturing here, we really want U.S. manufacturers to truly be U.S. manufacturers, continue with these high tariff rates and get away from the free trade agreements and all that other stuff. Even Canada and Mexico, which is going to be really interesting how that plays out in the next 5 years, because as we've talked about, even specific to automotive here, Mexican imports of vehicles are up double digits in the last couple of years. So how this all plays together is going to be really interesting. This is one sort of case study in what's wrong here and how this is sort of broken in a lot of ways. But at the end of the day, Ford was wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, they tried playing the old shell game here and it didn't work, probably because somebody finally realized what they were doing as opposed to just signing the paper and letting it go, you know? So they really don't have a leg to stand on, but I do think this offers an opportunity to look more closely at all of these things that we have going on for these import duties and seeing what makes the most sense in the long term to make the market more competitive. Mm-hmm. Some of this stuff makes sense. Some of it absolutely does not, in my opinion, but we do need to sort through them all.
So fact-checking myself and the Detroit Free Press. The Detroit Free Press did report that – so they said the Justice Department said – $365 million settlement, about $183,000 of that is going to be lost duties and et cetera, like I had mentioned. However, according to Law 360, they say that $183 million of that settlement is for restitution for lost duties and the remainder is penalties. That seems like a little bit more of an equitable split. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at losing 20% per product, 22.5% per product.
Yeah.
That would seem higher.
Yeah. That seems more... reasonable.
Yeah. I just, 10 years ago, it was a different time. Different time.
Well, in fact checking myself for knowing very little about where the origin of the chicken tax term came from, which thanks for that history lesson, Jeff. I am looking at.
No, that was a legitimate thing.
I'm being serious. Yeah.
We just both scored a piece of pie in Trivial Pursuit.
Exactly.
We should have had Andy Zoll come in and probably given a much more thorough and better.
When he watches, when he watches this, when I ask that question, I can hear him just.
Oh my God, you guys, idiots! Did you know, Andy Zoll, that between 1961 and 64, the surrounding issues were called the Chicken War? Did you know that fact that I found on Wikipedia just now?
I love how you're
now?
Being proactively offensive, just going after Andy, him before he even has a chance.
Did you know that, Zoll?
According to Wikipedia.org.
Yeah.
Ever heard of it?
Ever heard of it?
Well, again, another fun fact. Hashtag fun facts. Chicken taxes and chicken wars.
The chicken war.
I had no idea.
Same.
All right. Our most popular story this week. Can the world's largest plane save wind power? According to the U.S. Department of Energy, offshore wind turbines can be 1.5 times the height of the Washington Monument, with blades as long as a football field. So, aerospace engineer Mark Lundstrom and his company, Radia, started building the Windrunner. If the project takes off, the Windrunner will be the largest plane in the world. The Windrunner, there it is. The Windrunner would be used to bring huge offshore turbine blades to onshore sites that could help construct wind power installations that reach 300 feet higher than the average. Radia's Windrunner would be about 356 feet in length with a 262-foot wingspan and tires that are about as big as me. It would require a special 6,000-foot runway that would be constructed for each project, a 6,000-foot runway made for each individual project, and it would have to deliver a lot of huge components to assemble a profitable operation. Rachel Kelly, who is a former director of engineering at Boeing and Radia's VP of aircraft development, says, "This all actually makes a lot of sense, a lot more sense anyways, than towing blades on enormous trailers or using other forms of aircraft like helicopters and blimps." And Jeff, we've seen footage of some of these accidents when you have an oversized load with one blade on it trying to navigate, you know, our streets, and it just doesn't happen easily.
No, we did a couple stories. I know just on accidents that occurred with semi-trailers trying to haul these turbine blades, so you can appreciate where this is coming from. I think when we look at these types of things, especially in this case, we're looking at it sort of as a new product development, as an aerospace product. I would look at it more as this is like a grid or infrastructure investment. You know, if the engineering proves that this is the best way to go about getting these blades on site, I'm all for it. When we look at wind power, you know, all the numbers that I've seen, and I know you guys are closer to this than maybe I am, it's one of the most, from a ROI perspective, one of the best sources of renewable energy. It's also the most popular right now, twice as popular as solar. I mean, when you look at the whole breakdown, we got fossil fuels, we've got nuclear, we've got wind. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in the top three or four as far as what's contributing to the grid right now. So I think when we look at this, it's a very intriguing and it's intimidating when you look at the size and scope. That runway, we're looking at about a $12 million investment just to land the plane and hauling a lot of the stuff. And who knows how many times it's going back and forth, which is interesting then when you think about the carbon footprint in terms of fuel and everything else to in order to create a renewable energy source.
Yeah.
But if we're going to continue down this route, we want more electric cars. We want less fossil fuel usage. These are the types of investments that we have to look at with more than just a, that's kind of cool. That'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
We got to get real about this stuff and see if this does make sense. The one thing that appealed to me right away is eliminating a lot of those accidents when we look at over the road transport.
Yeah.
And also I think, just lost my train.
I guess, one of them could be like the damage of transport, right? Like it's one thing when it's very provocative when you see a semi truck trying to get across a train track, but it can't navigate the turn because the turbine is so big and then it gets smoked by a train. But there's also the handling, strapping that thing down, and just like the damage inherent with over the road logistics.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say is getting to some of these remote areas that are difficult to get to.
Yeah.
You can fly a plane in there. And a lot of places, you know, Texas being one of the best places for wind turbines and wind energy harvesting. I mean, you're looking at a lot of flat areas. So this huge landing strip that you would need for this plane, not as big of an issue there, especially when you look at other places throughout the Midwest. There's space for it, but we can't always get there because it's very cost prohibitive from a transportation perspective. The initial investment is huge for these types of planes if this can move forward. But over time, I think the ROI could be there for it.
No, and we're not talking about like, hey, we're going to put a turbine there. Okay, yeah. You know, it's not like we're going to build this landing strip to ship in three parts, right? Like, I mean, we're going to build these landing strips where we're installing huge, like large scale offshore wind farms. And, you know, that starts to make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Anna, your thoughts both on the design behind this incredibly huge plane and, you know, essentially creating an entirely new market for just one single application.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, when you talk about alternative energy, I think there's some, it's defensible to say, like, there has to be some new infrastructure change that are specific to these industries. I know that goes against what I say about hydrogen typically, but that's too much. That's too much. But for this, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, I would like to see, I guess, what happens, how the technology develops and what the cost implications are for this. You know, when you acknowledge that some of the challenges include things like constructing a 6,000-foot runway at every location and also transporting other very heavy components on site, like those are big things, you know, like those are just not small things. And I do think it's maybe a bit disingenuous, to suggest that the only other alternative is towing these on trailers, because we've seen, and I think even maybe talked about on this podcast before, how on-site additive manufacturing is kind of a growing area for wind.
Yeah.
And I think that could play a big role in making this process more sustainable and even more efficient. We're seeing everyone in the sector, including companies like GE that are big in wind, looking at additive.
Yeah.
We saw this massive crane. Maybe it was the crane that we talked about on the podcast. The massive crane that can lift up the turbines and the nacelles straight. It was like this huge hoist specifically for the wind industry. Like pair those two things together and you have a pretty good solution that, in my opinion, may be more cost effective or maybe quicker to market than building a custom airplane that's the biggest airplane in the world.
Or how they're talking about it, doing it more modularly, like how they're able to really automate EV manufacturing lines. The idea is that like you make it as lean and simple as possible and you essentially move the factory to each of these places. And really when you're talking about building an entirely new plane and a multiple 6,000 foot runways, I don't know. It doesn't seem as crazy when you're comparing it.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going to be the ultimate solution. Maybe it's both of these things, but I do think that it's not fair for them to say like the only way to do it is to make this giant plane. Like that's not, it's not the only way.
Or the comparison. Like, I mean, what could you use? Helicopters or maybe a blimp? It's like, yeah, all those blimps we see flying overhead carrying blades.
Or we just get a bunch of people to carry it.
Yeah.
It's either this plane or you have a truck that's going to hit a ton of puppies when it drives here. And like, what would you rather choose?
I mean, you have in Texas where they're clearing out all those schools so that way they at least have the manpower child power to carry these to every installation. I mean, at least that's more cost effective. Logistical challenges, like I had mentioned, are just staggering. 2 years ago, and I mentioned it, a train crashed into a semi-truck carrying a wind turbine blade in Texas. According to NS Energy at the time, the distance between most wind facilities is too great for companies to build manufacturing facilities within close proximity, which also kind of led to the ideas of, okay, well, move the manufacturing facility and make it smaller. Moving turbine blades, towers, and other components is so complicated that it often requires planning that takes more than a year to figure that out. So just, I mean, the logistical challenge, as I was reading this stuff, I'm just like, that is crazy. I mean, because if you think about it, there are probably so many roads you just can't get down.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before we move on to In Case You Missed It, we have another word from our sponsor.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, industrial equipment news, and manufacturing business technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Office MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Office MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Engelhardt has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Office MDT. He's also a member of the Office MDT product team.
Hey, we're back. And just a reminder that this week's episode is brought to you by Office MDT. Jeff, I was wondering, you know, you did this discussion on the secrets of OT data management. Why should people check it out?
We talked about a lot of different topics. I mean, usually this is one where you get focused on automation and a lot of IT related things, software, stuff like that. And really this one brought together a lot of different components. We look at operational technology. We talked a little bit about cybersecurity. Yeah. So it's not just about understanding how to get the data out, but it's also putting it into practical application, keeping it safe, making sure it's getting in front of the right people. So it was a lot of different facets to this one, as opposed to maybe some of those that we've done on a similar topic in the past.
Getting a little more bang for your buck on this one.
I think so.
Or I mean, bang for your no bucks because it's free. You just got to register.
There you go.
It's a good episode. Definitely check it out. Watch it now. In case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. I'm going to go first because I'm going to ride this train until it comes to fruition. And it's going to, because it's happening creepily fast. So Figure's OpenAI powered robot is already having conversations. And you're thinking, okay, yeah, it's just following prompts. It's not. You need to watch the video. It's crazy. About 3 weeks ago, Figure, a robotics company, and OpenAI, which made ChatGPT, announced a partnership to essentially upgrade humanoid robots with AI brains. Some said it was too futuristic. Maybe some on this panel. I'm not sure. Maybe close friends and family that I talk about all the time. But just 2 weeks after this announcement, Figure released some staggering results. The Figure 01 first generation robot can already have full conversations with people after connecting it to a large pre-trained multimodal model. The robot can describe its visual experience, plan future actions, and use common sense reasoning. In a video, Figure 01 identifies everything in its field of vision, gives someone an apple when they ask for something to eat, and then explains its logic and how it determined that the apple was the only edible thing on the table. While having a conversation in real time, Figure 1 also determines how to put away dishes and cleans up the trash, all while speaking in a very natural, almost too natural, scary tone of voice. Almost like, you know, it's that tone of voice that you hear when, like, your dad is so mad he can only talk in that tone. Or it's just going to be completely unhinged. I don't have this tone. My dad did. I certainly.
I've applied that tone.
Yeah, I got that tone. So I picked this because, as we've mentioned before, Figure already has a significant client in BMW, which earlier this year announced plans to introduce general purpose robots to its production lines. And this video, just more than anything else, when we've been seeing video of their capabilities, shows that I just think this is so much closer than we think to having these robots being able to engage in at first rudimentary tasks in factories, but way faster than we think they're going to be able to do very complicated tasks. Anna, your thoughts. Did you watch the video?
No.
Okay. You need to watch this video because, like, this all of this is contingent on how, like, when we think humanoid robot, we think Elon Musk tipping over a clumsy robot, right? This thing is fluid. This thing is moves like a human and is talking to you almost like it's a terrible Data from Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, it's wild where you're having this borderline human conversation that you wouldn't really know you were having with AI if it wasn't, you know, with a bucket of bolts in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, but it's closer than you think.
Okay. I mean, I don't have to like it.
Oh, no. I don't like it either.
Yeah.
It's just it is a reality. And, like, And I think it's coming. I think it's coming sooner. Like, yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had. And BMW bought in before any of this. So mm-hmm. I could see more people kind of like signing on to experiment, especially with this level, if they were able to create this level of automation in a 2-week window.
Potentially. And, you know, obviously the business application for things involving AI and machine learning and stuff like this is going to come way, way sooner than you're going to see this thing like out on the street trying to sell you a
personal assistant,
a map or something. I don't. Yeah.
Map of the stars.
Yes.
The first application.
Enjoy this tour of the Hollywood Hills. That's the voice, right?
Oh, yeah. It's straight out of the movie AI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I think right now that's the problem with AI and even, what's the company called that does ChatGPT? I can't remember the name.
It is, OpenAI.
OpenAI.
Yeah.
Is just, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about like the consumer, case for AI is not there.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of, I mean, there's just like a lot of vacant openness there of like, there's a ton of possibilities, but no one really knows what they are. And already we don't really use robots in our homes. Like, even though we've been talking about this for years that, I mean, I remember seeing like, there was like a laundry folding robot in development, like 15 years ago that I have yet to see. There's just, I don't know. I know that it feels like it's really close and that we're like ready to be taken over by, AI and bots and humanoid bots, but I do think that there's some build-up time there.
Mm-hmm.
And also there has to be an application and somebody to pay for it. So like these are really, this is really expensive technology. This is not something that's really like consumer ready. It's not really like municipality ready. These are, you know, whatever it costs to build these bots right now. Like I think I saw that, Boston Dynamics Atlas humanoid bot starts at $150,000. Mm-hmm. I don't see this infiltrating society at this point.
No,
I mean, I think the technology development is interesting to view as an observer, but again, there's just, I think we're a long way off.
No, when I say they're way closer than we think, I say they're way closer than we think on being on the shop floor. I think we see them in warehouses and manufacturing facilities way before we see them, you know, in the consumer market.
Absolutely.
But I mean, that's what's going to cause that economy of scale. So Jeff, we often ask why humanoid robots, because, you know, and you bring it up too, we can make them to suit specific applications, right? Well, yesterday, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang said it's because the data used to train these models comes from people. And when it comes to the data we need to train AI and feed it, what do we have the most data on? We have the most data on how humans move. So Huang told CNBC, we have the most examples of humans moving around of just about any other data.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that was kind of a wake-up call because we often talk about like, why are they fitting this square peg into the round hole and to the round hole, like trying to make it humanoid just to be so that way people could be even more uneasy around them. But it's just because when you're feeding its brain, the biggest resource we have is on human movement. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, sure. But what I think what happens in a lot of these cases is they forget to take in the real human factor, which is, yes, it's great that you can emulate that human being, but I don't want a fake human being around me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody does.
Agreed.
I think one of the biggest things as we talk about artificial intelligence is we need to recognize that the software is going to be decades ahead of the hardware right now.
Yeah.
Now, at some point, we're going to plateau on the AI software, and that's when the hardware can catch up. Because right now, you can have the smoothest looking humanoid robotic system, but if it takes up a ton of space and it freaks you out when you're looking at it, and right now, I don't need a robot to take my dishes out of the sink.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this really going to go? Okay, so I think there's a long way to go. You can talk about we're closer than we think. I don't think there's any doubt from a software perspective, but I think the hardware is a long ways away. I don't think we're close enough to get this palatable for most people.
No, I mean, that's probably going to be one of the biggest learning curves, right? Is making people comfortable working alongside these and trusting them. And I mean, I don't think the nature of AI is that it never plateaus. It will never plateau. Like,
It will if we get to where Elon Musk wants to go, where there's no humans doing work, because then there's nothing for the AI to learn anymore.
Well, I mean, the nature of AI is that it will continue to learn, you know, infinitely. And I mean, like, I mean, you could say that AI could learn to the point where, you know, the world no longer needs humans to.
No, see, I mean, don't buy into that, though, because it needs something original to build off of.
Yeah.
It's not going to generate original thought. That's not where we, at least not right now. That's not where we're at.
No, it does, but it does. It like, so the nature of AI is that it makes a decision. The person so this example in particular, the person asks for an apple and he hands them an apple and he says, thank you. Like that confirmation teaches it. So that way it improves going forward. And that just happens exponentially. So that way, whether or not it gets there.
But it can't say thank you in Spanish until you speak Spanish to it.
True. But then like, but it learns so much faster than humans. And so like,
yes, but it still needs that original human being input.
Like it does, but it could get to a point where AI learns off of its, like, its own actions.
Could.
Yeah.
Could.
I
think we're further away from that than we want to embrace, because I think the ways that we're using it right now, especially in manufacturing. So for this type of robot to take on an industrial application, I think would be amazing, because not only now we're getting into stuff where it's not just printing out QA findings. It's not just printing it out on a printer. It could actually say to the person working next to me, hey, we can't have this one for these four reasons. Mm-hmm. Get it out of here. And that is something that could be hugely beneficial in manufacturing right now.
Yeah.
So in that case, yes. But it's weird when they roll out a lot of these, and I know why they do it, these consumer applications or consumer situations.
Yeah.
Gets more headlines, gets more attention than saying, yeah, we're able to QA, you know, these different sensors coming down the line here and kicked out, you know, and that's going to mean a 10% improvement in yield.
Yeah. I mean, really, that's what they should have done is like, go get all the white boxes and palletize them over there. You know, like, but I mean, we saw that, and I was talking about Boston Dynamics. We saw that, and like, they were showing the one that was stacking boxes. And that one, in terms of popularity on YouTube, like, didn't even go viral because, you know, people are just like, stacking boxes. But you show the one like going over the obstacle course or like playing hockey, and then everyone's just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Anna, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
I selected a story about Walmart partnering with a 3D weaving startup for a sustainable approach to garment manufacturing.
Okay.
So Walmart announced a pilot project with a company called Unspun to use the world's first 3D weaving technology, which is a collaboration that, if successful, could help reduce the environmental impact of garment production, as well as offer a more sustainable process for meeting demand and shift more textile manufacturing back to the U.S. So the pilot is addressing concerns about waste, which is a big challenge in textiles. They say that there's a lot of fabric loss that comes with traditional flat weaving. So, you know, combining the more efficient process with reduced emissions that come with not having to transport these garments from offshore, they're creating a more sustainable supply chain. So the two companies are aspiring to collaborate in a more impactful way in the future. So Unspun says that it's got a manufacturing partner. They hope to deploy additional what they're calling micro sites across the U.S. With locations to be determined. But they said they anticipate having like 300 something micro sites in the future to kind of make that more of a local process. You know, it's I think it's a cool effort. If in theory, you know, I don't know, you know, 3D printing has not always been known for its production volume consistency. Mm-hmm. So I know that that's going to be probably a barrier in the case of like mass producing clothing for Walmart.
Okay.
But I do think that it's responsible for Walmart, a party like Walmart, who is implicated in this low cost, fast fashion, disposable fashion problem that's facing the world now, that they get involved in trying to fix this problem because, you know, it's a bad one. And we know that like the other component too is like tracking the full life cycle of textiles, which often wind up in a landfill, especially those that are low quality, low cost. And that really is deepening the environmental impact. So shortening the supply chain, reducing the material waste is one thing. But I think there's that other aspect as well. And Walmart, H&M, Shine, all those companies that sell you a t-shirt for $2. I think they are the ones that are profiting off this environmental catastrophe that is a product of the way we source fashion now and consume it as if it is a consumable product and we can throw it away after 6 months or whatever when the seam rips. It's we got to change that process. So this is a way. This is one way. I mean, I like the idea of creating a hyper-local supply chain. Again, I think there's some challenges that are associated with that, but an interesting start, an interesting way to have this conversation.
If you ever need an example of our disposable fashion culture, just go to a Walmart or really any box store during a seasonal change. Gross. So are we talking about, did they talk at all about custom 3D weaving pants for people, or is this just like, it's going to make X amount of larges, X amount of mediums, X amount of, you know, triple XL pants.
It's a pilot, so there's not a ton of detail around the exact specifics of how this is going to work. So I don't know, but I mean, it's Walmart, so I get the impression that this would be more of like a mass produced.
Yeah. But I mean, hey, if you could just walk up and say like, I want these jeans in this size, in this color. And then you hit a button and then there's, you know, you're not digging through that stack. Just like, all right, 32, 34, 32, 37, 38, 45. You know, it's just, and they have every size, but the one you're looking for. You know what I'm talking
been
about?
There. Yeah. Been there.
What do you think about this?
See, and I was going the other way. I can appreciate that Walmart has always been a quality over quantity type of retailer.
Quantity over quality.
Yeah. Type retailer. And I think this would allow them to go that other way. I mean, they're big, huge into e-commerce. So what they could potentially do is preventing all that overstock and all like you're talking about. Basically, anything that comes in online, this could be the solution to producing it. Yeah. They've got the pattern. They've got the material that would be used, all that kind of stuff. Print it up and send it out the door that way, as opposed to having all of that inventory in the store that they either have to discount and get rid of or gets thrown away.
Yeah.
So I could see it handling a lot of things and addressing sort of the supply chain stuff that you mentioned, as well as a lot of these e-commerce dynamics that people want to institute that could really help a lot of people run more efficiently, and not just the retailer, but also the manufacturer. If at some point you're not selling a physical product, but more the quote-unquote recipe for that product, so it can be 3D printed, how much more efficient can that make us in so many different ways?
True. And you know what? We talk about overstock problems at box stores, but there is an entire ecosystem of overstock stores that are supplied by like Amazon. Like you think like Amazon has it in its warehouse until it sells it, but it's not like, you know, they remainder things out like any other box store.
Right.
And it goes into the discount and then the waste stream. Jeff, what's your in case you missed it this week?
So I'm building a little bit off of what you had mentioned with AI here, but the story that caught my eye, because I love these that talk about, again, the real world applications, especially when it relates to things in agriculture. And this one was about a robot that does use an AI to help sort out diseased tulips. Okay. It's a robotic machine used in the Netherlands called Theo. And basically, if you looked at it, it looks like an oversized golf cart with sort of out the canopy on it. Mm-hmm. And it goes through the tulip fields. It has the built-in AI and it's on tracks. So 24/7, it can be going through the tulip fields, identifying the diseased tulips and removing them. It does that based on the AI that has been ingrained into it. In the past, they were doing this manually. It was a big deal because when the diseased plants get in there, it can wipe out the entire field, definitely diminish the yield, the product quality, all that kind of stuff. So when you look at where they're using this now for flowers, very controlled, very specific situation, but because it's AI, you could see this again being a thing that leads to a much bigger thing. When we look at agricultural specific and we look at applying AI to it, in this case, when we can identify diseased plants and remove them before they take out other plants, that leads to making better use of our natural resources. That means we don't need as much field to produce as much product. The yield is improved. It means we can use electric vehicles like this in place of humans, so we can have humans doing other stuff, looking at other data, and running these plant-based, whether it's a farm, a flower farm, or anything similar to it, much more efficiently. That means fewer emissions, again, better pricing potentially down the road for other products. We get into food. I could just see this being utilized in a lot of different ways than what it is right now, but it's a cool solution, even though it's very expensive right now. This is like a $200,000 piece of equipment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So not every farm is going to be able to roll Theo out there anytime yeah. soon, but it's the first step. And if we can make it better, maybe get the footprint down a little bit, make it more economically viable for others, yeah, this could have a huge impact. And we've seen other stuff like this. I just like to tout it and bring it out because, again, I think this is something that leads to bigger things down the line.
No, completely agree. And I would say more Xerox, you know, more copy machine.
That's a good call.
But the other thing is that it doesn't, like, remove it. It kills it where it is. Like, it kills the bulb. So, like, the remediation is right there. Yeah. So that way you don't have to, like, it's not like it's got to, like, pull it, kill it, and, like, remove it.
Yeah.
It's very efficient. Anna, your thoughts on the AI Tulip Killer 4000?
Yeah, it's cool. You know, I covered something for a partner recently on a robot called the CentiV, and it was the same kind of idea. It was like this rolling. It had these like flexible feet on its wheels, and it wouldn't like crush anything. It would just kind of like meander through the field, and like it used LiDAR and, you know, it would identify like if a, you know, something was needed water or something, there was a weed here or whatever. And it just would house all that data. But it didn't have that action component either. It was just more of like a fact finding type.
It would identify, mm-hmm. observe and report.
Yeah. But, and it was a much smaller scale, I think smaller price point type, but scenario. But, you know, this thing is awesome. And I think, like, as we've talked about in the past, anytime that you can apply AI principles or automation to agriculture, you're really getting a huge benefit out of that because, you know, you see these big farms. Really, I know that people in their minds think that maybe like agriculture would be an antiquated industry, but it's not. Often they're early adopters on some of this new technology because they are desperate for solutions to make sure that they're not losing money every single day. They're, you know, obviously their profits are like really tied to the weather. And so, especially now as the weather is getting crazier and crazier, being able to circumvent some of the issues before they start is just such a huge win. So yeah, very cool product.
You want to take a shot at that city name?
Nordwijkerhout.
Nailed it.
That's got to be it.
You know, the other thing too, you know, talk about all the big farms, and that's such a huge trend right now. And in some places, kind of a concern from a social perspective, we're losing that family farm. As this type of stuff becomes more commercially viable, that should allow individuals to go into business for themselves or stay in business for themselves because they will be able to compete because they don't need to have huge plots of land to feed a ton of cattle. They can do it a lot more efficiently with this type of tech.
Isn't that Interstellar? Like McConaughey's family farm and they have AI bots tending the fields.
It's been a bit since I saw that one.
Okay. I mean, it sounds
right.
Yeah.
I'm going to say yes.
Worth a watch. You're just, now you're being weirdly supportive. Now it's throwing you off your game. all right, let's move on to our final thoughts before we get out of here. Anna, what's your final thought this week?
So as you mentioned, I'm off next week, so I will not be on the Eggnog podcast, but the Eggnog cast. I will be on vacation with my family and it's spring break here, end of March, which inevitably means that it's going to start snowing tomorrow, definitely. Like just to kick things off. Cause it always, always happens. And every time I'm like a couple weeks prior thinking like, you know, probably the weather will be a little better by then. Yeah. We can do some things outside and we can't. Mm-hmm. So, I will report back on how much time I spend inside with my three wild children. We spent a lot of time in the pool. So,
well, it doesn't help that. So we had the premature spring sprung or like sprang, yeah. sprang prematurely. But then we got the cold snap. Right. So and it was, you're right. Like the kids were playing outside for a couple of weeks and then we hit a weekend that was super cold. So my final thought was like the kids just wanted to get out of the house. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to take them to a pool. Like we took them to the local pool. It's cool because they have the adult pool with family time and then a little kiddie pool with like slides and stuff like that where they can play.
Nice.
And I'm just saying like, so we jump in the pool. I'm holding the oldest. Carrie's holding our youngest. And we're just trying to, you know, just get, you know, two scoops of ice cream and the peanut butter jelly of the Just getting the hands and legs moving.
The swimming movements.
And, you know, it's super crowded there. Super crowded. And there's this one guy in particular, and he's throwing his kid up into the sky, which is great because I love to do that with my kids, and I'm about to do it competitively. And Carrie and I are just, like, going back and forth with our kids. And
throwing him? Just tossing
him? I didn't start throwing. I was, like, I was trying to get Dez back to the edge so then I could, I guess, throw him closer to concrete. Makes sense. But on our way back to the edge of the pool, the guy who's throwing his kid, he bails. And so the lanes are open. And Carrie and I are walking back, and we just kind of stopped to see, like, you know, are we going to move to the kiddie pool? Are we going to do this a little bit more? And then I looked down, and I was just like, oh, that's weird. And Carrie's like, it's got to be a Band-Aid. Must have fallen off of somebody. And so I go to kick the Band-Aid, and it's not a Band-Aid. It is not a Band-Aid. So my final thought is just that no matter how confident you are that your children are potty trained during a open family swim time, no matter how confident you are, swim diapers are very reasonable. Actually, they're grossly overpriced, but it's still worth it for the people that are there that might be victimized by your waste. And it was vile. I had to cut off two toes. Had to cut them right off. Gone. Yeah. I'm a eight-toed man now. Yeah. And I was actually very composed. Walked up to the lifeguard, and I'm like, hey, we got a situation in lane three that needs to be remedied. And then, like, because it was wave, because it was family swim time, they're just like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, let me assure you.
Yeah.
And so just a note to people, you know, hey, wear protection. And never go into the pool again. Jeff, your final thought this week.
The first thing, I just want to point out another article on our website. The EPA banned asbestos. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was still not completely banned until
Same,
I read
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
That was so way to go, EPA, taking a you know, finally getting all that cancer-causing carcinogen off the market. That's a good thing,
yep.
David.
Yeah, they finally did it.
That's a good thing.
They finally did it.
So that was good to learn. The other thing, just closing thought, I like to, as much as possible, sort of celebrate the little things, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. the things that make me happy. And one of those was last night at the grocery store. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I found the Jolly Rancher jelly beans.
Oh.
And I feel like somebody was kind of trying to be sneaky about it. Like they were there, but kind of like in the back and maybe pushed off a little bit.
Yeah.
So I did grab two bags of those, and that makes me very happy.
Where are they?
There's personal stash.
They're safe.
Yeah.
Anna, they're safe.
All right. If you really want to make it up to David, you could bring him into the office. Just saying.
On Monday.
As long as he doesn't eat the blue raspberry ones, which I know is the most artificially manufactured flavor on the planet, but I don't care.
I know that it's not going to be a hot take, but I don't care for the Jolly Rancher jelly bean. I like the traditional flavors. Someone dropped off.
They're too nice, right? You like the trash candy.
Yeah.
It is.
Over this.
I am. I'm a trash panda that loves my trash candy. No, but it was someone dropped off jelly beans. They're still very good, but like when I bite into an orange and it tastes like grapefruit, like something's broken in my brain where it's just like, no, no. Why? You don't need to overthink it. Orange is orange. Once a year. Easy. But no, I'm glad that you scored some jelly beans, man.
Made me very happy.
Yeah. See, sometimes it is the easy thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that kid had too many jelly beans before he got in that pool. All right. Before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. Just hit that thumbs up on YouTube for us right now. That'd be great. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Anna, David, or Jeff at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first, or subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday, except for next Wednesday at 2 p.m. For Jeff Franke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.